This is Bombshell, a podcast from War on the Rocks. We're here to discuss military strategy, White House mayhem, and the best cocktails known to woman. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Radha Iyengar.
And I'm Lauren DeYoung-Shulman.
We're all here for your entertainment and national security needs. So this is the first episode of Bombshell. Welcome. A spinoff podcast from War on the Rocks. And what we thought we'd do today is first to introduce ourselves and then dive into some of the big questions around national security and foreign policy in Washington, D.C. during the Trump transition. So if I could have Radha start, introduce yourself.
I'm Radha Iyengar. I am currently a senior economist at RAND. I started life as an academic economist.
We're sorry about that.
I know. Well, we all have our crusts to bear. Working at the London School of Economics, I actually met Erin Simpson when I did a round in Afghanistan, working at an advisory and assistance team there, doing measurement and evaluation for General McChrystal and then General Petraeus. I came to Washington, D.C., worked at the Department of Defense in the Special Operations Office, then went to the National Security Council, worked there on personnel readiness issues, went to the Department of Energy, and now I'm out of the government and back at RAND, watching things from the outside.
Excellent. Lauren, welcome.
Thanks. I'm Lauren. I am a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. I have been part of the DC foreign policy blob inside the government and outside for the last 10 years or so, starting at life as a presidential management fellow, worked at DOD and the National Security Council back and forth for about 10 years. Quit, had a baby, moved to California, realized that I am way, way too uptight to be a Californian, moved back to D.C., and now I have been at the Center for New American Security doing work on defense strategy, national security strategy for the last year and a half. And I met the two of these ladies through DOD world, through campaign world, through friends of friends, and look forward to this.
And we apologize in advance for the acronyms we may use on this show. I'll do my best to try to get folks to explain things. And I think we'll even at some point have an explainer series on defense and government jargon. I'm Erin Simpson. I'm the former CEO of Caris Associates and most recently just started my own consulting group called Archer Avenue Consulting. My first job in town was at the Marine Corps Command and Staff College. And if your first job is teaching Marines in Fallujah, from Fallujah, about counterinsurgency, pretty much nothing bothers you that much after that. As Radha mentioned, I spent some time in Afghanistan, also doing some campaign assessments and intel work, and then met Lauren after returning to D.C. and hanging out with the broader national security foreign policy crew. Hopefully one thing that listeners might take away from this podcast is that DC is a small town and it is a company town. And so we try to make the best of that, but you should always remember that in case you're having a bad day. It is in fact a small town. So before we dive into current events, I think what we're going to do is take a quick minute and we're going to interview each other just a bit and you can get a little bit of sense of who your hosts are, that there are real people behind these voices, and hopefully you get to know us better over the next set of episodes. So Radha, you're going to interview Lauren.
Lauren Shulman, let's start with, what is the best meal you've had when traveling?
Okay, so we need to clarify, are we talking about in an airport or while on an actual trip?
Let's do both.
Let's see, on a trip, the best meal I've ever had was hiking in Machu Picchu. We forgot to bring water and had went on a very, very long hike, came to the bottom of the hike and came across somebody who was selling Fanta and stale Oreos. And I inhaled those and was the best food I've ever had in my entire life. And if I see somebody selling Fanta and if I see stale Oreos, I still like have this magical moment. In an airport, by far the tacos at, or really anything at all, at Salt Lick Barbecue in Austin, Texas. No question.
All right. How about the book that you have had the longest or reread the most?
I have read Wrinkle in Time by Madeleine L'Engle probably 75 million times. And yet, despite that, could not really recite the plot to you because I always skip around in the book.
And now, what about the fan club that you were a member of? Some point in your life.
Okay, so two confessions. One being huge Dave Matthews Band fans, traded concert tapes around with people I met on the internet. also huge Star Wars fan, may have participated in AOL chat rooms about Star Wars, where we may or may not have role played as Star Wars characters during my youth.
AOL being one of those acronyms that's not defense related, but just age related for those youngsters listening to us. That would be America Online back in the before time.
Also, chat rooms, probably not something you know what those are.
It's like Slack, but different.
Right. You will notice that there is a slight divide in this podcast among the people who are Star Wars people and the person
who is not.
But I'm here to represent those people who think Star Wars is just fine.
That's fine, Radha. We'll let you claim that stick.
Your Twitter or Facebook secret crush.
Okay, I have a lot, but I will share that Libya Liberty on Twitter is one of them for being wise and hilarious and shutting down trolls with absolute aplomb at all times, but also somebody who is no longer active, NatSec Mad Libs, who was an absolute genius, and I must know who they are.
All right, rounding the last few. Favorite museum?
The Hirshhorn. That's pretty light.
Favorite geek field trip?
The Marines took me to pretend to be a Marine for a day, and I felt like a huge badass.
And favorite statistical distribution?
I have no idea what you're talking about, you weird academic losers.
Dang.
Okay, moving on. Aaron, what is the best meal you have ever eaten while on travel, airport and trip?
It's really hard to answer this question and not just sound like a huge asshole. So I think the best, it's probably a tie between my favorite sushi restaurant in the world, which is in Honolulu, Sushi Sasabune, which we call the benevolent dictatorship of sushi, and this trattoria that my friend Diana and I like wrangled our way into after a very long day on the Amalfi Coast, which was just unbearable. And it was some of the best food you've ever had in
your life. You even pronounced trattoria correctly. At least, well, I think so. That's how I say it.
That's exactly. That's right. How I do pronounce. I'm from Kansas, so you should definitely trust my pronunciation of foreign words. Best airport meal? I mean, I'm a sucker for McDonald's hash browns and a fizzy Coke pretty much anywhere
classic.
I go.
Okay, so what is the book that you've either owned the longest or read the most?
So the book that I've probably read the most, which may not surprise you too, is probably Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, okay, which I used to reread with pretty great regularity. Owned the longest might be something like T.H. White's Once and Future King.
Okay, excellent, excellent choice. What is the fan community that you have been a part of at some point in your life?
So at the other end of the Dave Matthews Band spectrum, that would be the Radiohead fan club of the mid-90s.
Wow.
Yeah, man. Special. I feel like we have a real distribution here, folks.
Yeah. Yeah. We're getting the tails.
We're really representing.
Who is your Twitter or Facebook crush from afar?
Well, it's embarrassing to admit because I'd like them to show up on the show, but Kai Rizdahl is a pretty solid Twitter crush, I have to say.
Absolutely. I also likewise have a Twitter crush on Kai Rizdahl. Favorite museum?
I'm a huge fan of the Picasso Museum in Paris.
That is an excellent museum, particularly an excellent museum to go to after lots of red wine. Favorite geek field trip?
When I was an Olin Fellow, we got to do a carrier trip. So we got to fly out on the Cod, do a cat and trap, as they say, catapult launch and a trap landing, and sleep on the carrier overnight. And I don't know. That's pretty much, it's like Top Gun, but real life. And it's pretty. No volleyball. There was no volleyball involved, which is a little disappointing, I have to say. But the rest of it was pretty awesome.
Okay, and then lastly, what is your favorite statistical distribution?
The negative binomial.
I have no idea what you're talking about. Good answer.
Excellent. Radha knows. That's all that matters. Okay, Radha, you're the last one up, and then we're going to move on. Number one, best meal eaten while traveling.
When out and about, it is. I just recently went on my honeymoon. We were in India for 2.5 weeks, and I ate at a restaurant, Bukhara, in Delhi, which if you're there, you should literally elbow people out of the way so you can eat there. It is truly delicious. And at an airport, it is. I was actually recently in Chicago, and you might think, were you there for the president's speech? And you'd be real wrong. I was there for a weekend conference in January with economists. The temperature was 3 degrees, and the Frontera hot meals at Chicago O'Hare, where I was not surprisingly delayed, was delicious, as was the sangria.
Well, they're doing it wrong, but that sounds like a pretty tasty, pretty tasty meal. All right, book you've reread the most or owned the longest?
Mine is Wuthering Heights, and because I feel like it's truly a tale of love and violence, which, when you think about it, summarizes a lot.
Well, we won't go into that any further at this moment. Fan club or fan community for you?
So I didn't actually have a good answer for this, but I will confess that when I was a child, I loved cheetahs. the really fast running animals. I thought they were awesome.
Yes, there those was a cheetahs. Thank you for clarifying. Cheetah
character on Thundercats. I'm just saying it's not some fancy DOD acronym. I mean the actual cats, which I find adorable. I made my parents adopt one. I wrote letters to the
like
agency.
In your house?
Yeah.
Right.
In my house with the dogs. No, with, right. you know, oh, writing okay. some letter. Right. I saw them on the NBC Today show.
Did you give it amazing. A name?
I didn't give it a name. It had a name.
It had a name.
Just go assigning names to cheetahs.
Twitter crush.
Lauren Shulman.
Good, obviously. Good answer.
That's how I know what's going on in the world, because I'm not that good at the Twitters.
That's how I don't do any work during the day, because I'm way too good at the Twitters.
Favorite museum?
The Natural History Museum in New York City, which, if you didn't know, has dinosaurs, and dinosaurs are big and cool.
They are both of those things. That's correct. Best geek field trip?
So when I was at the Department of Energy, I got to go on a submarine, which is both cool because, I mean, they go under the water. Mm-hmm. And because my husband is a submarine officer, which makes it useful for me to now be able to understand exactly why he is exactly the way he is.
And because you've never seen Hunt for Red October.
That's right.
So Rod,
I'm sure it's really good. Like Star Wars.
Anywho, last question, just for you. Favorite statistical distribution,
and it's the Poisson, which Aaron and I feel like means we're really a match made in heaven.
And if you understand that reference, you're going to enjoy the rest of this podcast. And if you don't, well, then you should listen to Lauren, because she hates all of this. All right, ladies, so let's move into the current events portion of our discussion here today. And because there's going to be a little bit of a lag between when this is recorded and when this is posted, we're not going to give you the hour-by-hour rundown of the confirmation hearings or the Trump news conference, because there's going to be 17 different news cycles between now and when our lovely listeners actually hear this. So let's start more broadly and talk about kind of, it's January after a presidential election in Washington. There's a transition in place. We're a few days out from the inauguration. What's it like? What's going on? And how does that political transition process work in terms of political appointees, civil servants, all that good stuff? Lauren, you want to kick that off?
So despite the fact that we do this every 4 years or 8 years or what have you, for some reason, transitions, every time they happen, people have a moment of panic and forget everything that went on before. That, yes, political appointees, including ambassadors, including folks at the NNSA and elsewhere, are asked to submit resignation letters as of January 20th. And frankly, these were probably done last November, right after the presidential election. Everyone always has momentary fantasies that they may be asked to stay, but regardless, you're usually asked to submit a letter of resignation, and then somebody decides, yes, you can stay, no, you're not going to stay. So that's what typically happens, but we'll still panic about it in the news on a day-to-day basis. But what that means in practice is that the political leadership at every organization in town is about to leave. And while that's only about 4,000 people out of 3 million or so federal employees, it tends to slow everything down to an absolute grinding halt, whether or not it absolutely should. So we're in a moment of slowness where lots of us are getting requests for coffee or lunch or early activities or bowling or earlier happy hours, which is atypical in January in Washington. It's usually a busy period. So it's kind of a disconcerting moment for a lot of folks.
I think that's right. And so along with the personnel transitions, there are the civil servants who are going to stay on, and they represent most of the government. They do a lot of the work that keeps the government running, from collecting the intelligence and providing the briefings to making sure Social Security checks go out the door to making sure programs and grants are administered. So in this transition period, those folks will continue to do those. Don't expect any big policy changes or any big changes in course in either direction. But at the same time, the next administrations will be sort of thinking about, the folks coming in will be thinking about what their policy priorities are and what the objectives of the new leadership coming in is once the confirmation process is underway. Typically, that's done with transition teams and landing teams that go to the different departments and agencies.
So, and there's been some controversy kind of around that, or at least a recognition that there was a delayed arrival by the landing teams. Is that how we understand this still for the most part with the Trump administration?
I think that's right, sort of compared to 2008 and 2000 and 2012, I guess. But transitions are always a little bit chaotic.
Transitions, yeah, exactly. Transitions are always chaotic. What makes this one a little bit different than the last one, and probably the prior one in particular, is that we haven't had that many names come out as appointees for the lower levels of government, both at the cabinet level, but also, you know, the deputy secretaries, the undersecretaries, the ambassadorships. And as a result, that means that confirmation hearings will be a little slower. The actual transition of those people who just start up their day jobs will be slower. I mean, they'll have to do everything from figure out where their office is to actually figure out what is it they're responsible for in the organization, how to get to the White House, do they have a driver? I mean, it's not an easy landing period. And as Radha said, the processes in government keep going whether they like them or not. And they're going to have to submit a federal budget in April. So they'll have 2 months at most to get their homework done for that. And while a lot of that work has already been done, President-elect Trump has made clear that he wants to have a completely different set of priorities. So a lot of it's going to have to be rejiggered.
Sorry, there's just a little bit of noise here in the room.
Possibly somebody knocking on our window from the 13th floor, but that's fine.
Yeah, that's not we're not concerned about that at all.
And along with the changes in priorities, there is the question of just the actual bureaucratic processes that often have political leadership as sign-offs. This is particularly true in the Department of Defense. So all of those operational processes that happen typically go through from the civil servants and military advisors up through assistant secretaries and undersecretaries. And so those processes will continue to be staffed, but they'll be staffed with people who are performing the duties of more senior leaders. And so that will also create both slowness and a little bit of friction as the changes come in.
You know, as our listeners probably know, the assistant secretaries, the undersecretaries, the deputy secretaries, and of course the secretaries of the departments themselves require Senate confirmation. But there's a vast army of deputy assistant secretaries, DASs, or at the Defense Department, DASDs, that don't require confirmation. And so, you know, not having lived this process directly myself, but my understanding, right, is that while we're waiting for all the unders and assistant secretaries to work their way through the process, the DASDs are able to file in, right? And they're able to sort of start that day-to-day work. But in a world where the deputy hasn't been named, the unders haven't been named, the assistant secretaries haven't been named, it might cause folks to either A, be reluctant to accept those positions because they don't know who their boss is going to be yet, or two, they just people haven't gotten all the way down to that part of the ladder. And that's certainly part of the chatter, I think, in town right now is everybody waiting to announce their decision that they're joining the administration, or are there genuine talent gaps, particularly on the national security foreign policy side of things, as we're watching state and DOD and some of the other departments as well?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the other part of it that is not totally clear yet is political appointees, even ones that aren't being Senate confirmed, go through a relatively onerous vetting process that includes things like...
Well, they used to.
Right. So it's not fully clear what that process is going to look like or how when those lower level slots can get vetted through the Office of Government Ethics, OGE, given the need to do that for higher level positions. So this is a slightly different ordering and approach to transition than we've seen before. Now, just to be clear, there is...
All those other approaches still resulted in some amount of chaos, right? So it's not like there's any one perfect transition.
And there
technique.
Are certainly advisors in the White House, and those folks, you know, could be staffed up starting for day one, right? The National Security Council could be staffed entirely by White House people if they wanted to, and that could operate starting from day one. So could the Council's office in the White House, Domestic Policy Council, right? So there's a policy apparatus that exists in the White House that's not under any specific department or agency, and that could be functioning from day one.
So a lot of this sounds like Kremlinology that just the elite in Washington pay attention to, but has some practical implications that, if I could wonk out for a moment, have actual real implications. So one of them being, so you just pointed out that they can staff at the White House very quickly, and they absolutely can. And Rahm Emanuel actually makes that recommendation of like, you should focus on that first rather than do anything else. But what does that incentivize is the meanest thing you can say to anybody in the White House these days is you are micromanaging me. So if you have a White House that is fully staffed and a DOD and a Department of State and a USAID and others that are, you know, kind of only partially staffed with political appointees, it's going to incentivize the NSC to take on a larger role earlier on. And it's going to be hard to break that habit a few months in when you have more senior level appointees. Like, they've already got their battle rhythm going. The other bad habit that will incentivize is if you, as you pointed out, staff the lower levels, like the DASs and the special assistants and others who don't need Senate confirmation, as they will all be working on pretty narrow portfolios. And absent some, you know, higher level prioritization, they will be able to say like, well, you know, I work on Europe and that's a priority, or I work on Asia and that's a priority, and I'm going to handle it my way. And suddenly you have a boss comes in that has a larger vision for the organization. And in the bottom up process that Michelle Flournoy and many others have criticized in this in the last several administrations is going to be in effect yet again. So these not having the senior people in place is, yeah, it's an interesting kind of DC parlor game, but it's also something that is going to have set really bad habits for the administration if they don't speed up this process in the next few weeks.
Yeah, and I think there is an extra piece of this, which is, you know, when we talk about defense policy, we often talk about like what should we do with our NATO alliances or nuclear war, but it's a huge section of defense policy that is how do we structure, staff, recruit, retain, and manage a force structure that meets our needs. And all of those policy priorities are actually executed by a combination of civilians and military personnel. And it's very, very hard to have an effective prioritization, and especially in a position where an administration might want to change dramatically from what the previous administration personnel policies are. It's very hard to have that higher level position when it's among junior, very narrow portfolios. And so one of the big consequences of not knowing, for example, the Department of Defense, what might be coming is not knowing what the priorities might be in terms of recruiting and retention at the time when we still need to make a budget that goes to the Hill and meets defense priorities. And that budget includes staffing and sizing the forces in the military.
So that's a great segue. Since most of our background, obviously there's a number of agencies that factor into the broader national security apparatus, but most of us kind of in our hearts are defense geeks, whether from a variety of perspectives. Let's talk a little bit about kind of what the first 100 days are for the Pentagon, both maybe as you guys see them, as they are, and maybe as you see them as they ought to be. You know, what are some of the things that obviously, we expect General Mattis to come in as a Secretary of Defense. We'll see how his confirmation hearings go. There's been a little bit of reported tension between himself and the White House. But what are we expecting in the first 100 days, Lauren?
So DOD loves nothing if not a good process. So automatically, regardless of what General Mattis, if confirmed, will want to do or not, they will, as I said before, be starting a budget process. They'll have to turn in a budget probably sometime in April, reviewing and revising whatever it is the Obama administration came up with to submit, which they normally would do in February of this year. So that's going to be a huge one, especially if General Mattis and President-elect Trump want to put their stamp on it, which Secretary Gates made a precedent of doing in 2009 by having a huge reform budget when he came in. On top of that, they're going to have to do some kind of replacement for the QDR, or whatever they're calling it these days, the Defense Strategy Review. That process will be launched to describe what is our defense strategy, what forces do we need for the department, force posture, the future investments that we need, and a lot of other kind of trickle-down strategies that will come from that. But most likely, my guess is where General Mattis will put a lot of his time into is doing an Iraq and Syria operational strategy review, as well as an Afghanistan strategy review, and probably more of a global CT ops one. And those, if I don't miss my guess, will probably kick off right away and should hopefully have some kind of White House leadership and State Department involvement, IC involvement, and really thoroughly imprint President-elect Trump's priorities. I mean, he notoriously said he's going to give the generals 30 days to come up with their new Syria strategy. Presumably, he'll give them whatever secret plan that he has, and we'll have some new, off-and-running, miraculous Syria strategy that will solve everything. And Radha, I'd be curious on your take on the Syria piece in particular.
Yeah, so sort of on your global CT, I would imagine that what's happening.
CT, ladies?
Counterterrorism.
Thank you.
Connecticut, but CT is probably what we mean this time.
I imagine what's happening right now is that the Special Operations Office and a number of other offices are working to put together day one briefs for General Mattis, should he be confirmed. Those will also have input from folks of the Joint Staff, which, just as a reminder for the audience, the Pentagon has a civilian leadership side through the Office of Secretary of Defense, and the military side through the joint staff and the chairman. That chairman is still going to be there. It's a there's continuity there, and there's staff there as well as staff in the office of the Secretary of Defense that is civilian civil servants who are going to be there through the transition. So right now what they're doing is preparing transition briefings, and that will allow General Mattis to sort of get up to speed on what should be happening. I think there's going to be a big decision to be had. We saw, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later, some initial sort of on the ground raids in Syria in the last week, which is a break from what we have seen in the past with sort of ground-based targeted operations by special operations forces. And I think, you know, there's going to be a real question of what are we going to use in special operations forces? What general purpose forces do we want? And those are going to be decisions that are going to have to be taken probably way in the early, in the 100 days. They're only decisions that the Secretary of Defense can take with advice from the Undersecretary of Policy and Assistant Secretary for Special Operations, neither of which we really know who they're going to be. And those forces, especially for direct operations, are going to have really, they're going to have a desperate need for prioritization. So it will be really interesting to see how they deal with the sort of near-term threats while balancing a longer-term strategy and the need for defense strategy and review of our relationships with European allies, dealing with Asia, all of that while, you know, there's this acute threat in Syria.
And certainly we've talked about the, you know, we're still waiting on names for the undersecretaries. So that's Undersecretary of Defense, Undersecretary of Defense, or sorry, Undersecretary for Policy, Intel, Acquisition, and then Personnel Readiness. In addition to that sort of, you know, those are all within the Office of Secretary of Defense, essentially. You know, there's the services side. We're waiting for announcements on service secretaries as well. The Secretary of the Army has been named, but not confirmed at this point. Names have been floated, certainly, for some of the other services, but that process seems to be a little slow. Certainly what I'm hearing is that General Mattis has claimed purview on the undersecretaries and maybe has ceded the service secretaries to the White House. We'll see how that plays out. But certainly a lot of the personnel issues, and Radha, you know, I know you've talked about these and worked on these things before, have play out within the services and not so much within the OSD side of things.
I think that's right. So, you know, the service secretaries and the service chiefs are really in charge of the force provision. And so what the Undersecretary for Defense for Personnel and Readiness, the person who reports to the Secretary of Defense, does is really try to coordinate across the services to try to align priorities and align policies so we have DOD-wide responses, and then deal with big DOD-wide issues, DOD health issues, DOD force readiness issues, sexual assault, suicide. But they don't typically get into the nitty-gritty on very specific force sizing and force management and force construction, because that's a service purview. Given the changes that have been made in the last few years and the changes in the budget environment and the stated priorities of Secretary Trump, the services are going to have a lot of work to do to think about what their sort of force sizing models are going to be and what they're going to request in their budgets. And so that will be heavily dependent on the priorities for those service secretaries to feed that into the budget process. And so we'll look with bated breath on who the actual service secretaries are and then what their priorities are in the confirmation hearings.
For sure. And obviously there's a bigger question. There was a hearing in advance of General Mattis's confirmation hearings on the Senate Armed Services Committee with Kath Hicks, who's a friend to all of us, and Elliot Cohen, who's a mentor to many folks here in town, talking about civil-military relations. And obviously it's a bit of a disjuncture to have a recently retired general officer coming into the post of Secretary of Defense. I wrote a piece on that for War on the Rocks just before Thanksgiving, talking about some of those issues. Where do we think sort of the broader civ-mil conversation is? It's hard to tell at this point in the transition process because nobody is confirmed yet, and we don't really have big crises or any policy processes in the mix. But do we have a sense of where that state of play is, or, you know, is it all wait to be seen?
I think a lot of it remains to be seen in how the Situation Room dynamics play out, the White House Situation Room. So, you know, imagine a principals committee chaired by General Mike Flynn, the, you know, to be not confirmed, but appointed national security advisor, that has General Mattis as Secretary of Defense, General Dunford as Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Kelly as Secretary of Homeland Security, as well as several other members of the NSC who have some kind of military background. That's a really different dynamic than the prior NSC, particularly when you're talking about use of force decisions, and particularly when you're talking about a president-elect who himself does not have a lot of experience working with the military. I have no doubt that Kelly, Mattis, Dunford, they...
Who are thick as thieves, of course,
absolutely.
Right? And old friends.
All Marines. All know their lanes in the road very well. I don't have a good... I mean, the current administration has struggled a lot with civil relations and understanding, in particular, the role of the Joint Staff and the Secretary of Defense. I have no doubt that that tension is going to continue to play out in this administration, and that having General Flynn as an interpreter in some ways may ease that, but also may actually make it a lot harder. So, I mean, just imagine a scenario where President-elect Trump has asked for military options. That's something that, you know, General Dunford should be coming forward with. But then he turns to General Kelly and says, based on your experience, how does that work out? What does General Kelly say? You know, presumably he answers in some sort of, you know, appropriate manner, but it's a completely unheard of and bizarro situation that I can easily see playing out over the next few months, and one that we're not really prepared for.
I also just want to walk it down the road, and actually, Aaron, I will turn this question back to you after I say this, which is, you know, I also think General Mattis is particularly thoughtful about the issues of civilian oversight of the military, and that, and the role that the secretary should play versus other military advisors. So that makes him kind of unique for this position, and in some ways argues that we could be less worried. My great concern is actually that this sort of opens the door to normalize that as a Secretary of Defense. And, you know, there are lots of general officers and flag officers who are much less thoughtful about those divisions. And so I wonder what the things we want to be on the lookout for to sort of to make this a one-off and not, I mean, this has happened before in history. That was also a one-off. So what needs to happen for this to be a one-off versus something we should be watching for in the future? What should we be looking out for?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great question. And there's some near-term pieces. You know, I've noticed as we've talked today that we're also referring to them by rank. We refer to General Kelly and General Mattis. They're not confirmed secretaries yet, so they, of course, maintain their rank.
And DOD habits die hard.
And, you know, so I'll be very interested to see, you know, the way that both the blob deals with Secretary Mattis and Secretary Kelly and civilianizes them into those roles. I do think it's going to be tricky because these personal relationships between, in particular, the three senior Marines here run quite deep. And, of course, Bob Work, who's been asked to stay on potentially as the Deputy Secretary of Defense, as a former Marine as well. So the Army might be shaking in its boots a little bit.
Is it not the case that, like, civilian secretaries also have personal relationships with each other? Is there a reason to worry about why these military relationships might be different?
The only thing that I could think of there, Radha, and I think it's something that, you know, you might be able to reflect on as well, that there's something about relationships that are born through deployments and combat. And these guys were overseas in similar times. And there's just something different about those kinds of relationships. To be fair, campaigns can also bring about, it's not exactly obviously the same kind of shared hardship, but it's stressful, long hours, kind of isolation. It'd be interesting to think about if there were people who had such long and deep relationships as kind of this triumvirate. But I do think it's, in terms of long-term, you know, what to watch, certainly you want to watch for questions of inter-service rivalry. You know, do the other services feel put out by this Marine triumvirate? And the Marines, of course, being very, you know, shy, wilting flowers, I'm sure they'll be very, you know, cautious about all of that. The second would be, do we see over time retiring 2 and 3 and 4 stars, nudge, lobbying for subsequent administration roles. And there's a long history of appointing various retired officers to these positions. It's the Secretary's defense role in particular that provides me a moment of pause. And, you know, we'll just keep an eye on that. And let Lauren talk one more, and then we're going to run to hotspots.
I would say a couple other things to look out for is kind of going back to the process of developing military options. That process has been quite messy, the Obama administration. There's been a lot of tension in that. Accusations that the White House is getting too tactical, that is asking questions that are not appropriate of, you know, civilian control. But in a lot of ways, that messiness is deliberate and you know, develops a, you know, Elliot Cohen's reference to the unhealthy, or not healthy, the unequal dialogue between civilians and military, and how that's actually a useful and beneficial part of civilian control. I would worry about a dynamic where you are saying, like, all right, go develop military options for country X, and it is done, and there's not a lot of kind of give and take and back and forth there, which people who have had, you know, similar education, similar training, similar careers, they'll have a shared vocabulary and shared understanding and perspective in ways that, you know, a civilian who came from the diplomacy world or from the business world may not share with, you know, General Mattis or General Dunford or General Flynn. So I would look at that dynamic to see if there's being an appropriate give and take back and forth between the civilian side and the military side in terms of when it's appropriate to use military force. The last thing I would say is pay attention to the 2-star, 3-star, 4-star nominations in this president, in this president's administration. It's not unheard of for presidents to have affinities or, you know, look for affinity in GOFOs as they are, you know, nominating 4-star and 3-star appointments. I could easily see it in this administration. President-elect Trump has mentioned a purge of general officers. I don't know if he'll go through with that, but it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Interesting to say the least. So now I want to move to a segment that we're going to call What Are You Worried About? And that could be, we're going to try to stay away from the existential dread, although there's a number of ways in which that might rear its head. But there's obviously a number of hotspots. It turns out there are things in the news that happened in the last, you know, week or so that did not occur on Capitol Hill or on BuzzFeed. And so we're going to try to focus on those here just a little bit. So, you know, of the many things that we have, potential flashpoints, potential crises, potential hotspots, you know, what are we ladies worried about? Radha?
So my sort of attention in a worrying sense has been distracted a little bit by the recent ground raid in Syria, which I alluded to earlier. And so the upshot of this is the press is reporting and the coalition dealing with Syria, U.S.-led coalition dealing with Syria, has confirmed that there was a ground raid in Syria. Press is reporting. We haven't had any confirmation on deaths and captures, so we don't know what the target operations. But we have not. The U.S. has not had directed specific targeted operations in Syria, except for a handful of examples. The Abu Sayyaf raid in 2015 being the most notable. But so the question is really whether this marks a shift in military strategy and a sort of willingness to accept, sort of go be more aggressive in our targeting of ISIS leadership. That's much more the model we took with places like al-Shabaab in Somalia, with the AQAP in Yemen, where we think that leadership targeting was pretty effective in at least at subduing those groups, or whether this is a one-off and the change in administration is going to change this policy or something in between. And so I think, you know, Syria is a long and complicated issue, and there's a whole host of issues with Turkey and Russia invading, but a marked shift in U.S. willingness to take direct action in Syria against ISIS is certainly something to pay attention to.
And certainly interesting that that's happening before January 20th.
Right.
Yeah, that's. Is it your understanding that that would likely have required White House sign off for something like that to happen?
I mean, it in the processes that are standard, the White House would be involved in that final decision for ground troops in Syria.
For sure, Lauren, what are you worried about?
So I'm worried about something happening on or around Inauguration Day, either in North Korea or in China, Taiwan.
What's going on in China and Taiwan?
Well, right, so China has I'm by no means an Asia expert, but China has recently made a couple of actions around Taiwan, sending a carrier there, and it's, among other things, that made a lot of people really nervous. DPRK obviously has made people constantly nervous for the last several years, on top of which, you know, threatening various tests that are keeping arms control walk on other people up late at night on the Twitters. So between the two of those, the reason I'm really worried about them is less that they're going to, that North Korea and China are going to do something that are truly catastrophic, and more that our incoming administration will be ill-equipped in the early days of the administration to deal with the crisis. And not that they won't be good people, not that they won't be smart or anything like that, but you don't have that common sense of, okay, so this happened, here's what we do, here's who we call, here's what we mean when we say a proportional response, or what we mean when we say crisis or risk. Like, those will be new terms to them, and they'll be working with new people around the table who either will have very close relationships, as we talked about, or will have no relationships or history in their buildings at all. So even if they come in with, as Trump alluded to today, that the best cabinet ever, then that's going to be a really tough situation for them to walk into, particularly if they don't have their mid-level teams to kind of handle the day-to-day crisis operation.
Yeah, I mean, I think North Korea or DPRK is certainly on the top of my list. They've had missile tests or other weapons tests in January of last year. They're certainly attuned to the political calendar here in the United States and are able to exploit that. If you go back to this discussion about political appointees submitting resignations, Mark Leipert's the ambassador to South Korea. He will not be the ambassador as of January 20th. I'm sure there's a very capable deputy chief of mission or DCM in that role, but it just feeds into a potential for not all hands on deck for what's you know, unfortunately, been a long running. I mean, it's 20 years running, essentially, or more, of a North Korea nuclear program eking its way forward and an increasingly risk-acceptant regime on that Korean peninsula. And I am literally the farthest thing from an Asia expert, but that certainly has me quite concerned on that front. One of the other things I did have my eye on this week is that we're sending Marines back to Helmand. That was an interesting and controversial decision the first time around, and sort of been litigated both. Rajiv Chandrasekaran had a great discussion of that in his book on Afghanistan. But there's Marines are going back to Helmand, this time in an advising mission. But it certainly has echoes of the earlier deployments, both from 2008 and 2009.
Especially given this uptick in Kandahar coordinated violence, which could easily shift west, right?
Absolutely. There was a huge attack in Kandahar this week, which I heard this morning the Taliban is not claiming responsibility for, which leaves open the possibility that it was possibly an ISIS-related attack. Kandahar is not really Haqqani territory. And that just opens a very big door for a variety of... certainly, there was, as Lauren said, there will be likely to be an Afghanistan strategy review in general, and that's probably warranted. President Obama is... increasing or leaving more troops there than he had intended at this point in his administration. But that's going to be, I think, it's not even so much a hot spot. Like, it just does not generate the kind of attention media-wise that Syria or other places in the Middle East have tended to do.
It's more like the slow burn that's going to set your house on fire.
Absolutely. And it's been, I mean, it's been a slow, I mean, it's probably dominated. I mean, I started graduate school on the day after 9/11. And, you know, this has been, you know, it's now 2017, right? So this is literally 16 years of a conflict in Afghanistan. And we're about to send a fresh crop of folks, you know, back into country.
And this whole concept of an advisory role, I worry that, you know, calling it that is going to do a couple of things. One, convince us that we are not taking as much risk as we actually are by sending these 300 troops there. Two, not necessarily giving them the support that they may need if things go down and they end up needing some kind of help of some kind. And three, the whole discussion about whether or not they're in combat, you know, that Josh Earnest has tied himself in knots over, this is dissociating...
That's the current White House press secretary.
Right, that's dissociating that, you know, whether or not we have troops at risk overseas from the American public and, like, not allowing them to play a part in that debate. And that whole question of, you know, how are we engaged in the world? What are our troops doing overseas? What should, you know, use of force look like in this administration? That's something that General Mattis and others will have to grapple with in their first few months in office.
If I could just add a little bit to Lauren's point there, because I think it's spot on. And I think we end up having these semantic discussions on, are these combat forces or not, which is not meaningful to anyone. It's not meaningful to us here if they're blown up, and it's not meaningful to people there who see Marines in uniform walking around. And the real questions we ought to be asking are things like, what are their rules of engagement? How much advising are they doing in the barracks, and how much are they doing out on operations? How close to an objective or a target when these guys are operating are the U.S. advisory forces allowed to go? And if we don't call them combat operations and spend all our time focused on that, we really don't ask the questions that we need to understand as a public to decide whether the risk that our troops are taking on are commensurate to the benefit to American national security. And I think we're missing a big... It's a big issue. It's an issue that's been going on in Afghanistan for a long time, and we put a lot of people in a lot more harm's way than we publicly talk about.
So we've got some potential crises in North Korea, Taiwan, ongoing efforts in Afghanistan, certainly, and Syria. These are all things that we worried about, which brings us to our final segment. What are we drinking? Lauren, what are you drinking? Which we should, I should note, is not what we're drinking now, because you ran out of champagne here in the conference room about 20 minutes ago, which is hashtag sad trombone. But more broadly,
I think what we learned is we're a two-bottle a podcast crowd.
Well, we'll keep that in mind for the future. That's right. Yeah, sourcing requirements, very important.
And we take contributions. I would be a lot funnier with additional champagne in the room. What am I drinking and why? So lately I've been drinking whatever red wine is available in my house, which tends to be whatever red wine is available at the crappy little corner store around the corner from my house. And the why is that my almost 2-year-old son, who is adorable and I will talk about frequently, I apologize, has been demanding to watch Bob the Train, a YouTube show, regularly. Bob the Train, Bob the Train. I'm really worried that Bob the Train is a communist plot and that
it's not the only one.
The songs that he sings are just really ever so slightly disturbing in a way that I can't quite tell how he's being brainwashed and indoctrinated, but I'm positive that it's happening. So if you know about any nefarious Russian plots about Bob the Train, please send them my way along with a bottle of crappy red wine. Aaron, what are you drinking and why?
I'm drinking a lot of bourbon, I have to say, which in some ways isn't surprising because perhaps I am known to drink a fair amount of bourbon. But I actually laid off the bourbon for the most part, and then I started again. That's pretty much. So I love an old-fashioned. I love a rye old-fashioned. But for the most part, I drink bourbon and a giant ice cube, which of course, our wonderful host and Poobah Ryan Evans is notorious for not having insufficient ice in his domain. But the why, I think, gets back to the existential worry. I think that it's going to be a very rough, I hope only 4 years, but this is going to be a difficult period for all of us. I do not have the Bob the Train problem currently, but the bourbon, you know, is certainly on the menu.
It's Rada. Medicine for the soul.
What are you drinking?
So I am drinking, keeping on Aaron's train, I'm drinking a filibuster whiskey. I'll just let everyone ruminate on that, and I can recommend some liquor stores in Capitol Hill if you're seeking such whiskeys. But the why is, you know, in golf, when there's another group and they're kind of playing faster and they're going to go through, but you're going to get to the 18th hole on the end. You let them play through. So I'm drinking through. Just, you know, I feel like I have the filibuster whiskey. I don't have a lot of other control over my world, but that whiskey I can drink and replenish at my own speed.
And that is why we are brought to you by War on the Rocks. This has been Bombshell, our very first podcast. We hope you join us in the next couple weeks. Thank you. Bye-bye.